From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Our economic crisis has many ironies. On the one hand, car companies are in deep trouble and the government can't decide if it's willing to bail them out. On the other hand, gas prices are down below $2 a gallon in many stations across the country. To give us the economic big picture, we've got Keith Reed, and you can find his wisdom online at Keith Reed's Money Corner. Welcome back.
Hey, Farai, how's it going?
Things are going good. So let's just talk very briefly about this Bernard Madoff situation. He headed up a high-power stock trading operation. He served as the chairman of NASDAQ, one of the most powerful financial markets and engines in the world, exchange markets. He was arrested and charged with this fraud scheme, which could cause losses up to $50 billion with a B dollars. Now, there are plenty of super wealthy victims, but one of the things that's come out is that he's really been able to defraud a lot of philanthropic funds. And this is not a good time for charities to be losing their money. What do you think is the importance of this case, and how important is it that charities are losing money due to fraud?
It's really a terrible thing right now, Farai. If you think about what happens on the back end at many nonprofits and for many charities, anything ranging from your run-of-the-mill charity that helps the homeless on down to colleges and universities, when money comes into those institutions, they go back and invest it. Many of them have endowments. Many of them have very, very large endowments that, and essentially that money is not sitting in your everyday checking or savings account. That money is invested in various different vehicles, usually with some investment manager, so that they can continue to generate income that will then fund their future operations. What happened in this case was that many charities, especially those involved in doing work in the Jewish community in particular, had invested money with Bernard Madoff's firm. And, of course, those losses are really taking a big toll, especially when you consider, again, the timing. This is happening at a time when charitable contributions are just dwindling in some cases to nothing. People are just not giving the money that they had been giving in previous years because of the economy. A lot of people are losing their jobs. A lot of people made their charitable contributions through their jobs. You know, if you go to work and they have a program where you automatically deduct a certain proportion or percentage of your pay via United Way or some other charity, you can imagine with all the job losses that we've seen this year what might be happening to charitable giving. So for much of this endowment money, many of these investment funds coming from charitable foundations being lost to something like a scam, a Ponzi scheme, is really devastating right now.
Yeah, we're going to definitely keep moving ahead and looking at this story, just the latest in a series of extremely troubling stories. And let's go to another one. Auto bailout. Didn't have enough gas to get through the Senate. Now, it needed the support of at least 10 Republicans. Came up short. GM and Chrysler have said they might face bankruptcy by the end of March without government help. What is your analysis of the state of play with the White House saying they might step in and use other funds for a bailout? How are things shaping up for people in these regions?
Things are bad for people in those regions. I mean, in some instances, things are just going from bad to worse. There really right now isn't. There's almost no good economic news, especially if you're in a region, especially many parts of the Midwest, some parts of the South, where so many jobs are responsible or are owed to the manufacturing sector, of which automakers in the United States are the biggest part. So that's this bailout not getting done is really not good news for those people in those regions. What's happening politically right now is, I mean, you've got a situation where, you know, the Republicans have in Congress have come out and essentially said, listen, we are holding the line on this. We don't see any real responsibility coming out of these automakers. We don't know whether, you know, and we might want to force them into bankruptcy. There's a debate going on right now about whether or not a bankruptcy, a forced bankruptcy, some sort of a structured agreement where they agree to file Chapter 11 and restructure themselves, is something that they need to do before they can have any money released to them through any congressional bailout. And there's some thought now that if this doesn't get done this week, that it might just be left on the table for the Obama administration to come in and deal with after the first of the year. The problem with that being is that the automakers have made it clear that they may not make it to that point if they don't get some sort of a bailout. So there's this stalemate. There's this gamesmanship going on. It looked pretty encouraging at some point that something might get done last week, but then it failed. And no one's really sure if it's going to move forward at this point or not. But really, really a high-stakes political game with some very severe consequences on the table right now for working families, particularly throughout the Midwest.
I want to talk about a couple of different things that are very critical in their links to the big picture. 250,000 people employed directly by the big three automakers. Then there are all these subsidiary companies that produce goods. Of course, there's, you know, any number of repair, upgrade shops, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And GM has just announced that it's going to close 20 plants, cutting back production in North America by a third. Sales haven't been this bad in 26 years. What is it doing, you know, to your state, Ohio?
It's bad for Ohio. I mean, there are, especially in the northern part of the state, in Cleveland, as you get a little bit closer to Detroit, up the area right along the lake, there's a considerable number of people who have jobs working in plants or in operations that supply the auto industry. Bad news for that business is bad news for those towns. You have to really think about, you know, there are towns in this state and towns across the Midwest where the major industry is still, if not automaking itself, is still something relative to automaking. There are some places where the economies just are not as diverse at all. They've never been diversified at all, like they have been on the coast or in other places where you've had some manufacturing that went bust years ago. The auto industry didn't go away in the same at the time that, you know, some other manufacturing operations went away, like textiles, for example. There was a huge textile industry in Massachusetts and in New England for a long time, but that went away so long ago that it gave those cities and towns that relied on that manufacturing base the opportunity to really diversify their job base and their economic base. And that just never happened in some of these places that rely on the automotive industry, because the big car makers were still producing and selling cars. Now that's sort of come home to roost in a lot of these places, and that's why it's so why there's so much drama around this bailout, because there are literally places where, you know, where thousands of people in these small towns stand to lose their jobs, and they don't have anywhere else to turn for another job if these go away.
Papers, you know, newspapers, mm-hmm. have been a real core for many years of how we think of our civic life. And mm-hmm. the news in Detroit may soon be harder to get, literally. The Free Press and the Detroit News are expected to announce some dramatic changes. What's going on?
What they're considering at this point is whether or not they will cease home delivery of those newspapers, except for the highest circulation days, which are on the weekends. If you've ever worked at or been involved with a newspaper, which I was for many years, you know that those Thursday, Friday, and Saturday are the biggest circulation days for the papers on weekdays. Sunday would be the biggest circulation days for any daily newspaper overall. And what these papers have gotten to a point of saying, of looking at, is, you know, hey, look, we don't make that much money. We don't get a lot of revenue from circulation anyway. Newspapers make the bulk of their money from advertising, not from subscriptions. And when you're losing a ton of advertising revenue. You're not making that back up on the subscription side anyway, and you never were. You've got to figure out some sort of way to make the economics of this work. Well, they haven't been able to do it online because they don't get as much money for advertising online, and they can't charge people for content. So they've been laying people off, but you can only lay off so many people and still produce a newspaper. So this is yet another way in which newspapers are shrinking themselves, desperately trying to figure out a way to stay viable as businesses by no longer doing home delivery. They haven't made a decision on this yet, but my guess is they'll probably do it sometime soon. And it probably, given the economic situation, doesn't look very good for those people who are home delivery subscribers.
All right. We have time for one last topic. Why is gas so cheap? And will this help the economy? Just a little taste.
Gas is so cheap because demand has gone down. And not just demand in the U.S., but worldwide demand from factories and major producers, major manufacturing sectors over in China, many other places around the world. It's gone down. In some ways, it looks good for us domestically because we were so sick and tired of paying $3 to $4 a gallon on gas and that. And you may feel like it's great for that to go in your pocket. But the problem is the underlying factor because that demand has gone down. Well, what does that mean? The demand has gone down because nobody's producing anything. And this is just a signal of how bad this recession is around the world, is that these factories are shrinking. They're no longer producing and they don't have the need for gas. One other thing that they don't need is employees. So it's not necessarily the great thing that you think it is, although there may be some short-term, much-needed and long-needed relief for your wallet.
All right, Keith. Always great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Farah.
That was our money guru, Keith Reed. He blogs at Keith Reed's Money Corner. He joined us from the studios of WCPN in Cleveland. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The president got a heck of a reception this weekend during his trip to Baghdad, and Oprah is back with a call to lose weight, starting with her own 60-pound gain. It's all on today's Bloggers Roundtable with Rob Redding of the Redding News Review, Kay Tempest Bradford of the Angry Black Woman blog, and Ron Scott, a blogger for the Detroit News. Hi, folks.
Hey, Farai.
Hello.
How are you, Farai?
You know, this wasn't really on our agenda, but Ron, I hope you don't mind me asking you about this. We were just talking with Keith Reed, our economics contributor, about the possible distribution cutbacks at the Detroit News. Do you guys have any knowledge that kind of axe on distribution is really going to fall?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, yesterday... many of us heard about it, and earlier in the week about the possible two-day circulation. It's just reflective of, Farai, what you've been talking about in relationship to the economy. There's just a fallback. People are in a situation where distribution is directly reflected to advertising and also the purchase of the newspaper, and it's just really a challenge. So, yes, we've gotten an indication of that. Probably we'll be doing a lot more online. But once again, the revenue stream is certainly challenged.
I'm sorry to hear that. And definitely we are trying to keep track of all of our people in media who are in the trenches. Want to move on to politics. There is an incident that causes some people to roll their eyes, some people to laugh, some people to get upset. And I'm talking about the shoe and the president. President George W. Bush went to Iraq this weekend to make a final visit to the country. He was having a press conference and a journalist, Middle Eastern journalist, threw a shoe and almost hit him in the head. That gesture is considered a strong insult in Iraq. And ABC News' Martha Raddatz interviewed the president right after it happened. Let's listen to his response.
You know, I thought it was interesting. I thought it was weird. I thought it was unusual to have a guy throw a shoe at you. But I'm not insulted. I don't hold it against the government. I don't think the Iraqi press corps as a whole is terrible. And so the guy wanted to get on TV, and he did. I don't know what his beef is, but whatever it is, I'm sure, you know, somebody will hear it.
The beef included calls that America had killed Iraqi children. So, Rob, what do you make of this incident?
Well, I think it's unfortunate. The Office of the Presidency of the United States is an important office, although the man is a joke that's holding it. I think he's a ruler, a dictator, and a tyrant. I've said that time and time again about George Bush, but he deserves respect because he's the President of the United States. As far as him trivializing it and saying that it's just a guy that wanted to get on television, it's an oversimplification. I think it's an unfortunate incident, and I think that he is trivializing it by saying that, oh, it's just a guy who wanted to get on television. I don't know what his point was, but I'm not insulted by it. That's because he doesn't understand and has never understood why people are so upset at him.
Tempest, when you heard about this, watched it, whatever it is you did, and of course it's become quite viral now as a viral video, what was your reaction?
Well, although my first gut reaction was probably to laugh, really what the first thing I wondered about was, where was the Secret Service? It seemed like this guy had time to, you know, throw two shoes at the president, and the Secret Service didn't seem to be in play there. So that was actually the first thing that I thought. I agree that, you know, him trivializing it, saying, oh, I don't know why a guy would want to throw a shoe at me, like, that shows either he's just being sort of facetious or he's completely clueless, because I'm sure that guy felt that he had a lot of legitimate reasons, one of which he screamed at the president. He said, you know, here you go, you're on your way out, and I'm going to throw a shoe at you because you've killed Iraqi children, you've, you know, killed my family, etc. I don't agree. I agree that he should not have thrown a shoe at the president, regardless of his feelings, but I can definitely understand why he, you know, felt that he could do that.
Farai,
yes.
This is Ron. I just want to jump in, and I love the name of Tempest Blog. I just have to say that. Anyway, the thing of it is, I think just not too far from there, there had been a bombing near the Green Zone, not too far, a car bombing. And it just emphasizes that George Bush was suggesting that this was democracy at work. Well, there's still a battle. There's still a war going on in that area. And I think it's not that he's clueless. I think he's just basically a little bit arrogant and really does not respond to the genuine feelings that people have who have been involved in really a terrorist act, a battle for all these many years. And I just think he is not emphasizing the human cost that this has been reflecting.
I want to go back to something that Tempest said. I'm reading this from U.S. News, their website, and they say, White House reporters are worried that the Secret Service and the Bush press office will now impose even more restrictions on correspondents and photographers in an effort to prevent such an incident from happening again. So there's also a lot of talk about what kinds of restraint should be on journalists and observers when it comes to the incoming president. Do you think that incidents like this should cause a rise in security? Tempest or whoever wants to jump in.
I think they should, because yeah. Barack Obama definitely has some concerns here. He is the first black president coming in. We've seen the racist surge, the Barack-tion level, as I call it, across the country. This is a concern. And as far as George Bush goes, one of the things that he also made, which is why I think he just is clueless and doesn't get it, is because he also made a comment from from the podium, from the lectern, talking about the middle fingers that he always sees when he's driving by, and
right.
kind of trivialized that as well. That's the reason why I say this guy just doesn't get it.
Please go ahead.
I'm sorry. I think basically that the thing of it is, we're talking about a particular ideology here that is being reflected that goes back to Bill Kristol and all these guys, that they basically do not consider other parts of the world and some of the people in those parts of the world as you know, consistent with the values that they hold dear here in America. And I think that leads to a certain amount of arrogance and elitism and the specter of empire. But in terms of the restrictions on the media, I think while there should be some increased security, I'm always concerned about how that it plays out in terms of who's restricted and how, and who's credential and how. I think there needs to be at least some rethinking of the security factors. But I think that in terms of legitimate media concern, we need to know as much as we can, especially in these crucial times around the world. So I just think you need to balance the two much, much more tepidly.
We have been hearing from Ron Scott, who blogs for the Detroit News, and you're listening to NPR's News and Notes. I just want to bring everyone's names back to the table in case folks are tuning into our bloggers roundtable midway through. So we have Ron, also Kay Tempest Bradford of the Angry Black Woman blog, Rob Redding of Redding News Review. Of course, I'm Farai Chidea. This is NPR's News and Notes, and we have a lot to talk about. One of the things that's come up that, you know, the bridge for me in these topics is the idea of security and the security of the incoming president. The inauguration is officially on fire in the sense that it's bigger than anyone. And someone who I know in Washington, D.C. is just really concerned. I mean, for the public safety of people who come to D.C. without any infrastructure, without a booked hotel room, without transportation within the city. But there are some people who are getting the red carpet rolled out for them and getting one of those key protected seats at the inauguration. And one of them is a group of Tuskegee Airmen invited by the president-elect to the inauguration on January 20th. And of course, they made history during World War II as the first black military pilots. But when they came back home, a lot of them had to go straight to the back of the bus. And one of the airmen, John L. Harrison, said that this invitation compensates for some of the discrimination that they had to endure. Rob, do you think, I mean, obviously that's his opinion and he is a Tuskegee Airman, but do you think that getting your due late in life is something that can heal the wounds of the past?
Well, certainly it helps. I don't think that it will definitely heal the wounds. I think that's a bit of a stretch. I mean, there's so many folks that have fought the struggle. The Tuskegee Airmen, of course, they waged a valiant fight to integrate the armed forces and to serve their country. This does go a long way. I'm glad to see that Barack Obama understands the significance of this moment and has wanted to include them in it.
Tempest, it's actually Senator Dianne Feinstein of California who sent the invitations. Do you think they should have come directly from the president-elect?
Well, I think it depends. I mean, basically, if the president-elect has asked, you know, a senator's representatives to reach out to people in
and she's running the whole inauguration
right, you know,
from Senate side.
Right. So in that case, it seems like it is appropriate for it to come from her because, you know, when she's inviting someone to the inauguration, it is also an acknowledgement from Obama. I mean, probably no one is coming to this inauguration without Obama and Obama's people knowing about it. So, you know, I think that that is appropriate.
I'm going to transition us, Ron, to another topic. Now, these are two interrelated topics that really have to do with health. And one of them is Oprah Winfrey, who we'll get to in a second. The other one is Obama the smoker. He was busted by Tom Brokaw on Meet the Press for dodging the question of whether or not he had quit smoking. And here's how he responded.
Have you stopped smoking?
You know, I have. But what I said was that, you know, there are times where I've fallen off the wagon.
Well, wait a minute. That means you haven't stopped.
Well, fair enough. What I would say is that I have done a terrific job under the circumstances of making myself much healthier. And I think that you will not see any violations of these rules in the White House.
His main thing has been, I will not smoke or people will not smoke in the White House. But whether or not Michelle has to put him in a headlock out in the yard is another question entirely. So, Ron, because Michelle has been his biggest public critic of all people. She's like, if you see my husband smoking, just give me a call on the celly. And
I'd like to say to the president-elect, denial, denial, denial. You got to get away from denial, and you got to step up and acknowledge it and give full disclosure. Because he made it clear that when we look at the health issues in the African-American community and the community in general, that, you know, smoking really is a major addiction. And, in fact, it's being peddled around the world. I think it's growing in China by leaps and bounds, in Africa, and so on. So within that context, I think, you know, he really needs to get engaged in some cessation programs. Some people have suggested they've seen him, you know, chewing on Nicorette and so forth. So I certainly hope that this public attention brings to our minds and to his mind the necessity of being around for his girls and others in the future. And similarly with Oprah, I mean, these are two major factors in the African-American community and the community in general. And I see that all the time. It is just really something that we take for granted. But these kinds of things are really, really, should I say something that's already known, really killing us. And I hope President-elect Obama listens to his wife.
Well, I'll fold in the Oprah topic right now because Tempest, Oprah is going public again. You know, a lot of people in the chattering classes and the supermarket checkout lines had been seeing various depictions of her gaining weight over time. And first it was like, oh, I just have a thyroid problem. And then, you know, now she's said that she has, quote, fallen off the wagon, her words, of healthy living. And her good friend Gail King even went on Good Morning America to talk about Oprah's struggle with weight. Ron seems to say, look, these people, Obama and Winfrey, are role models. They have an obligation to deal with these issues. What do you think?
I think that because Oprah is a public figure and because her battles with weight have been so public and out in the open, not necessarily that she has an obligation, but I think that for her own peace of mind, it is good for her to talk about it and it's good for her to deal with. I mean, just for anybody, it's good to be healthy, just in general. And I, as I was reading the excerpt from her article in O Magazine about this, I completely recognize the struggles that she went through. You know, you have some medical problem like, you know, hyperactive or hypoactive thyroid, and that can start a whole snowball effect, stress, which I'm sure she's a very, you know, stressed person because she has a lot of responsibilities. Stress really adds to that. And that can all lead up to becoming depressed. And then when you're depressed, you know, and even if it's a mild depression in that way, that can really affect what you do with your health. I have gone through some of the same stuff, so I totally understand everything that she's going through. And I think that not necessarily for any obligation that she has to the community, though that is a part of it, but she just needs to do it for herself. She does it for herself, then she makes an example for the community.
Well, Rob, what do you think?
I agree. She has to do it for herself. I mean, people used to walk around. I used to be 315 pounds. I'm 130 now.
Wait.
For 12 years.
Let's rewind. let me just say, you because you talk so fast. You used to be 315 pounds. You're now 130,
right.
And you lost the weight over 12 years?
No. I lost it all in 6 months, and I've been keeping it off for 12 years.
Oh, wow.
Under a doctor's close supervision.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Yeah. A lot of people don't know that about me. So this is a serious issue. Addictions, food addictions are very serious issues, and you don't get overweight by doing something other than in a lot of cases, let's just put it this way, there are issues, that medical issues that do arise and crop up that have something to do with weight gain. You know, big boned, that's always been the argument. But Oprah has definitely got to watch this. She's got to do a little bit better job making sure she moves her feet more than she moves her fork here. And, you know, to Barack Obama, I think this is an important lie, because I like to watch people when they lie or when they kind of take the truth and kind of twisted, and he says, well, there's not going to be any smoking in the White House, that kind of
right.
thing. That's the lawyer coming out of him. So I just like to point those things out.
Wow.
I have to give you
major props. Oh, go ahead, Ron.
No, I just said I lost a lot of weight, too. I lost about 50 pounds a couple of years ago, and then I've kept it off.
Oh, my gosh.
And I have to agree. One of the things that one of my friends does now is that he encourages me, and I think for both of these figures, they need to have really a strong support group. I think some of us are strong enough to try to do it ourselves, but I think the support group activity is very important in our community. A lot of times, as was suggested, we fall into depression and we try to anesthetize ourselves, and we really have to get away from that.
Sure.
Well, I would like to ask a request of you, which is that if you can... Well, I'll be in touch with you. I would love to get your stories up on our blog or link from your blog to ours, because I think it's an inspiring revelation that both of you have walked this path. So we have to wrap it up here, but I'm going to give you guys a ping. Thank you so much.
I would love to
thank you.
We were talking to Rob Redding of the Redding News Review, Kay Tempest Bradford of the Angry Black Woman blog, who joined us from NPR Studios in New York, and Ron Scott, who blogs for the Detroit News, and he joined us from WYCD in Detroit, Michigan. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. The late, great ragtime composer Ubi Blake had a song, "If you've never been vamped by a brown skin, you've never been vamped at all." Well, that's some pop cult dating wisdom from 100 years ago, but finding someone you love is a much more serious prospect, and race comes into it, as does most things. Joe Williams has been thinking things through. He's a recent divorcee who just returned to the dating world. He's also the deputy chief of the Boston Globe's Washington Bureau, where he wrote an article about the racial politics of dating. He has agreed to give us his take on interracial dating, along with George Yancey, a professor of sociology at the University of North Texas. Hi, gentlemen.
Hi, how are you?
How are you doing?
Doing great. So, Joe, let me start with you. You wrote this article for the Boston Globe magazine reflecting on your return to dating, and you are recently divorced, so it's been a while since you've been out on the range. And so, what are the biggest challenges for you?
Well, I must say I really like that quote. I mean, it's a great quote about vamping brown skin, because yeah. I'm trying to vamp mine, but to limited effect. Basically, a lot of it has to do with the fact that I'm older. I'm of a previous generation. And what got me thinking about the piece was the fact that we were about to have a president who is in many ways post-racial, and his election, a lot of people were saying, was post-racial. And it was coinciding with me trying to enter back into the world of romance, which was scary enough on its own. But to even start thinking about crossing the race line at this age was a little bit daunting because of the way I'd grown up. I grew up in the South. I was, the single. You know, my parents had daughters, and the son was always warned, particularly growing up in the South in that era, that look, there are some things you don't know because you just have to be careful. So to even start thinking about that, and then all of a sudden I start exploring the world, and it's like, wow, this is completely different than when I left it. Not only is it evidence of a post-Obama generation coming to cultural maturity, but also the fact that my own mind has to get opened up a little bit, and that's basically what I was trying to express in the piece.
So, if I may ask, what's the state of play, player?
The state of play is sidelined, shall we say. I mean, there's so, way too much going on that right now it's not even possible to think about that. But I know that when I do have like a spare moment to even reflect on this sort of thing, I often wonder, because you know, I was in an unsuccessful relationship with an African American woman, and that's not necessarily a soul thing. I mean, it's not a cause and effect thing, but certainly thinking about a long term relationship with a person who is not of the same race as me still gives me pause. I still sort of wonder about that. And I still don't feel entirely comfortable with it, so I'm not sure where it goes from here.
When you walk, have you ever been in a situation where somebody basically called you out for either the reality or the theoretical prospect that you had been or would date white women? I mean, some people can get really salty.
Well, yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, my first experience in college, when things were still brand new, I was called out a couple times, like, yeah, he's going to end up with a white girl. And I was like, wait a minute, where did that come from? You know, mainly because at that point I was really new to the scene. You know, I'm coming to college. College is supposed to be a place where you experiment, and that really hadn't entered in my mind. But you know, many people just kind of called it, probably because of my background. And you know, certain times, and I'm certain some people can tell by the way I speak that you know, sometimes it's open to question. I've had black people wonder if I'm white if I talk to them on the phone, and I've had white people say really insulting things, especially along those lines. And, you know, it's a fact of life for some black men, for young black men, and particularly in this era where things are changing. It seems that we're going to have to think about a different mindset, and I'm going to have to change my mindset and do it differently.
Well, on that note, I'm going to bring in George Yancey, who is a professor of sociology. You've been doing research on the acceptance and perception of interracial coupling. So what did you learn?
Well, clearly there's a lot more acceptance than there has been in the past, and I think that's reflective in some of the dating patterns we've seen. People about 45, 50 or older are highly unlikely to interracially date relative to other individuals. But, you know, below that age range, we find a lot of people willing to interracially date, relatively speaking, compared to that upper group. So that, to me, denotes that the cohorts today are much more open to interracial dating. Now, what is interesting is that it's still that people choose who they're going to date racially. In other words, you know, a person may be open to dating Asians or Hispanics, but not dating whites or blacks. But the idea of only dating your own race, that's becoming less and less common today.
Why do you think, I mean, or how about this? Do you think that things will change in the Obama era, in the sense that a lot of people, you know, people in you know, my circle of journalists have been covering multiculturalism, biracial identity, all these things for years, but now people with a president who is black and biracial are looking at you know, things like his parents' marriage as well as his own. Do you think we're seeing a trend line towards more acceptance of interracial relationships as well as more interracial relationships, period?
I'm not 100% sure that having Obama as president is going to qualitatively increase the acceptance. And the reason why is that he is hardly ever described as a biracial president or a biracial president-elect. He's always, that I hear, described as a black president. So I think that in people's minds, even though they know that he has a white mother, he's still perceived as being black. And we have a history of a one-drop rule where that's just sort of seen as, okay, he's black. So, you know, we have gotten more acceptance of interracial dating over time, but I guess what I'm saying is I'm not sure that Obama's president is going to necessarily increase that any faster.
Well, I also this one thing that sort of raised, if I can jump in on thinking about and talking to people about what I wrote, is that the question of what would have happened if Obama had married a white woman. That, you know, certainly if he is biracial, he does have, you know, half of his family is white. Would that have changed America's perception about him, and specifically, would that have changed Black America's perception about him?
Do you think that it would have put the kibosh on him?
Speaking personally, I think probably yeah, because there still is, even though it's socially acceptable on a certain level, on a higher level, on the plane that he's playing in, you have to be conventional. I mean, you can witness his wife, his children, his family arrangement. I mean, nobody's wearing dreads. Everybody's pretty much mainstream. And I think it's still seen, and this is just my personal opinion. I don't have any research to base it on, but it's my personal opinion that on a level like that, I think it probably would have caused more. I think it probably would have caused problems.
Overall, I'll start with you, Joe. The question for you would be, overall, are you hopeful on a personal level that you will be able to follow whatever it is that's your North Star in dating and not let race complicate things too much?
Hopeful is probably the best word for it. Likely is still probably too far in the past. I mean, I think simply because of my age. I mean, I have a lot of qualms about that I still haven't been able to reconcile, one of which I was trying to work out in the piece, is that, yeah, it should be okay to do whatever you want to. And I firmly believe that. I believe strongly in the right for gays to marry, for example. And I believe very strongly that people should be who they want to be with, if they make them happy and if they hurt no one else. But personally, it's different having been steeped in tradition, having been steeped in you know, racial education, for lack of a better word. That's still pretty difficult for folks, or for me personally in my generation, to kind of overcome.
George, when you hear that, what does it say to you?
Well, what Joe's is describing is something that I see in my research. There's a sort of a paradox there. What I found is that African Americans are actually more open to having people in their family interracially date than other racial groups, yet they are less willing to interracially date themselves. So Joe's sort of describing this paradox as he just says, well, yeah, in theory, anyone should be able to date whoever they want to date, and yet he shows a hesitation that's there, which I think is in the black community. So I think there's a paradox that we don't completely understand why it's there. I have some, you know, speculations as to why it's there. And that's what makes this research so interesting.
Well, and speaking personally, nobody wants to be called an Uncle Tom, because that sentiment is still out there. I mean, if I can be, you know, mm-hmm. as crude as that, that sentiment is still out there, and it's a lingering thing in the back of my mind. I mean, if I happen to end up with someone who is white or Asian, there's always this question, because I know quite a few African-American women who are single who lament the fact that there aren't a lot of good black men out there, and I've heard the talk, you know, why are you going out with a white girl? You know, aren't sisters good enough for you? Well, that's not the whole story, and it does carry a lot of baggage. And again, I'm speaking only from my personal experience and from my era, which I don't think is going to be represented too much longer. I mean, I guess I'm hopeful that it won't be represented too much longer, but there there is that lingering suspicion up there.
All right. Well, there's a lot to talk about because we could fill a whole show with this, and we might one day. But for now, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
We were speaking to Joe Williams, the deputy chief of the Boston Globe's Washington Bureau. He joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C., and George Yancey, professor of sociology at the University of North Texas. Unity, self-determination, creativity, purpose, cooperative economics, collective responsibility, and faith. Those are the seven guiding principles of Kwanzaa, the December celebration that honors the roots and traditions of the African-American experience. Author and filmmaker M.K. Asante Jr. celebrated Kwanzaa as a child. Now he has made a documentary about how the holiday developed and why people celebrate. It's called The Black Candle, a Kwanzaa celebration, and he's here to talk about it. How are you?
Hey, I'm great. Thanks so much for having me on. Peace to you and all your listeners.
Thank you. So what do you remember? What's like your first Kwanzaa memory?
The first Kwanzaa memory I had was being in school and, you know, they did a, it was an all-school auditorium and, you know, we had a Christmas and we had Hanukkah recognized, you know, and I remember standing up in front of like 1,000, you know, people in my school and saying, you know, what about Kwanzaa? And I was about 9 or 10 years old at the time. And, you know, that was a real significant moment in my life because what I did was I recognized, you know, what I celebrated, you know, my cultural holiday. And ever since that moment, they began to institute Kwanzaa, you know, into the school as part of their annual holiday celebration. So I feel like, you know, today with the film and with what I'm doing now, it's kind of an extension of the work that I started when I was 10 years old.
You have some pretty incredible people in this film. You know, you have younger, older people who are academics. Who's your, I wouldn't say your favorite, but who what's one interview that you particularly enjoyed?
Well, you know, when I got the idea for the film, you know, I called Dr. Maya Angelou, and, you know, I said, Dr. Maya Angelou, I want to make a film that uses Kwanzaa as a vehicle to celebrate the African-American experience. And when I told her that, she said to me, she said, we must make this film. And from that moment on, she worked with me. We collaborated together. She became the narrator of the film. She wrote poetry for the film. And that experience, working with her, being side by side with her, collaborating, was just a remarkable experience for me as a human being, but also, obviously, as a filmmaker. So that was something that really stood out to me. And as well, of course, working with the founder of Kwanzaa, Dr. Maulana Karenga, was a really important experience, you know, and really invaluable in terms of the film. So both of those experiences were really incredible for me.
Now, we have a little bit of Maulana Karenga from your film. Let's take a listen.
Kwanzaa insists on us facing our Africanness, appreciating it, and raising it to the level of sacred observance. We get our sense of self from how we assert ourselves in the world.
How do you interpret what he's saying there about getting your sense of who you are in the world?
Oh, well, I think it's so important that, you know, people, all people, understand where they came from and not be ashamed of where they came from. So I think it's vital and instrumental, especially in this, you know, timely era that we're in, you know, to recognize, you know, where we come from. And for African Americans, that clearly is Africa. And I think it's important to embrace that. So I think that's what he's speaking to, and I think that's what the film speaks to, being proud of who you are, embracing your heritage. You know, there's this Adinkra symbol in the Ghanaian tradition, the bird, the Sankofa bird, and it says that one must return back in order to move forward. You know, one must return to one's past in order to move forward. So I think that's what the film does, and that's what Dr. Karenga is speaking on there.
I have to ask you about this. He was convicted of assault for torturing two women who were part of a black nationalist group. Do you ever talk to him about that time in his life? And does it give you any pause that the person who started this holiday that's celebrated by so many people has this as part of his life?
You know, for me, with this film, I'm focusing on the seven principles. I'm focusing on celebrating the best of African-American history and culture. So for me, that's been my main focus, you know, with this project since day one. And I would say for the people who think about those things, to reconsider what was happening in, as far as the COINTELPRO in this country, the counterintelligence program that the FBI started was a plan to disrupt and neutralize, sometimes kill, assassinate, and defame the leaders of the 1960s. So when people like, you know, Fred Hampton were murdered and people like Huey Newton were arrested and shot, I mean, all of this is about the COINTELPRO. So I would just, you know, ask people to remember what was happening and
Let me jump in because we did do a big piece on COINTELPRO. It's a lot of history people should know, and I will blog about it on our blog. But I want to give you a final note about this film. Just in a brief time, what are you planning on doing for Kwanzaa this year?
Well, you know, I'm so happy to be able to screen this film all over the world. So basically, every day of Kwanzaa, I'll be in a new city screening this film. We've been screening this film all month. It's been a tremendous, overwhelming experience. Thousands of people have been coming out, celebrating Kwanzaa with us, watching this film, because this film, you know, is a celebration of the culture, the history, the heritage. It gives people a way to identify with the seven principles. So you can look on our website, the Black Candle. And that's where we list, you know, all the different screenings that I'll be at, different screenings that are happening all across the country. So I'll be at screenings celebrating, you know, with people all around the country.
Well, happy Kwanzaa.
Happy Kwanzaa to you, too. Thanks so much, Farai.
Thank you. That was author and filmmaker M.K. Asante Jr. He wrote, directed, and produced the film The Black Candle, A Kwanzaa Celebration. And that's it for us for today. You can go and listen or subscribe to our podcast at nprnewsandnotes.org. Join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium.